welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. With the 2006 congressional elections approaching, we're seeing more and more argument among liberals and conservatives about who counts as what. With those on the left rejecting Joe Lieberman and Hillary Clinton as too far to the right, while people on the right are rejecting people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham as too far to the left. Peter Beinart's new book, The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again, argues that the left needs to return to its tradition of Cold War liberalism, one that aggressively defends freedom abroad while trying to perfect it at home.
Beinart is an editor at The New Republic and a columnist for The Washington Post. He also writes regularly for Time and often appears on The Hugh Hewitt Show. We've got him on the phone now.
Hi, Peter.
How are you?
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
So our first question is, why don't you just briefly state the thesis of your book?
Sure. The argument is that there is a liberal story about how you fight totalitarianism, and I see jihadism as a kind of totalitarianism. But it's been lost by many liberals. There's a conservative story that I think you can date from the 1950s that George W. Bush, I think, represents the fruition of. But the liberal story, which I think really has to do with the idea that America doesn't inherently represent good in a struggle of good and evil, as George W. Bush suggests, but we have to earn the right to be considered good. We have to prove to the world that we're good, that we're fallible. We're capable of acting just as badly, as Aditya shows, as anybody else, but it's our recognition that we are capable of acting badly that leads us to take certain steps that make us a uniquely, exceptionally great and moral nation.
And what kind of steps are those?
Well, in the international sphere, it starts with international institutions. First, because of the recognition of interdependence, the recognition that there are problems in the world too big for the United States to solve, that pandemics or jihadism or financial contagion can emerge in one part of the world and strike the United States without very much warning, as we learned on 9/11. The second part, and I talk about this in my book, The Good Fight, is the idea that America has to be always struggling to become more democratic and more just at home. That the liberals that I talk about in the 1950s in my book don't call America in 1953 a model of freedom for the world. What they say is that what will inspire the world is America's struggle to be more free, to be more democratic. And so they linked civil rights and anti-communism, the struggle against McCarthyism and anti-communism. And I think that's different from what George W. Bush does. He tends to describe America as a kind of a country that's past the democratic finish line and doesn't have any more work to do.
Yeah, I noticed that. I wonder if that's not a bit, to use a word people aimed at my own book, Pollyanna-ish, in the sense that one of the things we've learned since the war began is that these international institutions, such as the United Nations and the EU, are in fact appallingly corrupt and full of people who are quite willing to sell the terrorists the rope with which they will be hanged. And what's the response to that?
Well, look, I think that there is a lot of corruption to go around. There's also been a lot we've learned about this administration. But I think the answer to the problems in international institutions is not to abandon international institutions, unless you believe that America has the capacity and the legitimacy to respond to these kind of problems alone, which I think it doesn't, or if you believe America has the ability to kind of wall itself off. The answer, it seems to me, is to try to reform these institutions. But when I say reform, I mean, I think, something different than what John Bolton means. I mean empower. I mean allowing the UN to act more aggressively, more proactively in failed states. Their record on peacekeeping is a lot better, actually, than people give them credit for, as this RAND study shows. But they're doing so really on the cheap with third world troops. We don't participate at all, and yet we know that peacekeeping is the best way of preventing a failed state from becoming an incubator for terrorism, disease, these kind of things. There are other institutions outside of the UN, for instance, the Community of Democracies, which I think we should put more emphasis into strengthening. These kind of things will allow us to do the work we need to do, but not to do it alone, and to allow us to do it legitimately.
Well, I'm somebody who broke with the Democrats, mostly really over national security, the pervasive sense, which you discuss in your book, that many are sort of embarrassed to talk about these things and embarrassed to talk about the country being worth defending and uncomfortable thinking about specific actions involved in defending it. What are the Democrats going to do to win over people like me, which I gather is kind of a big part of your agenda here?
Well, you know, I'm more a liberal than a Democrat, but I would certainly love to have you back. I think the Clinton administration was actually making some real progress on this score. If you look at where Clinton was by the end of his administration with Kosovo, which was an aggressive, proactive, action, actually in the internal affairs of another state, and we didn't even have UN approval for it. We recognized that we couldn't get the Russians on board, so we went through NATO. And we ultimately ended up not only saving those people, but ultimately toppling Slobodan Milosevic. It was a very proactive action. The polling also showed in the 1990s that there wasn't much of a partisan difference between Democrats and Republicans in their views on the use of force. What you had was a Vietnam hangover that I think Democrats started to get over by the 1990s. And now you have the wake of Iraq, which has produced enormous anger, and I think some of it justified, perhaps a lot of it justified. I say this as someone who I think supported the war, but thinks that he was wrong. The danger for liberals, what we need to make sure we don't do, so we have a chance of convincing people like you, is not to fall into the trap of reacting in some of the same ways we reacted in Vietnam, by overgeneralizing and by suggesting that, in fact, America doesn't have a mission to spread democracy and fight totalitarianism around the world. That would be a grave, bad reaction to Iraq.
But it seems to me that many Democrats actively want us to lose in Iraq. What can the Democrats do about this impression? Because that's the impression I come away with.
I don't think that's true in my experience, the liberals and Democrats. I know. I think Democrats and liberals are pessimistic. I think they're angry. But I don't think they think our capacity to win is less than what Republicans think. I think they think we're further in the hole in Iraq than Republicans generally tend to do. I don't think that the Democrats and liberals want us to win in Iraq, lose in Iraq, because the consequences for all of us would be so terrible. But I do agree that I think Democrats and liberals, particularly liberal activists, should be more willing to express outrage at our enemies in Iraq. Some of those enemies are Iraqi nationalists that we're going to have to deal with politically. But some of them, these jihadists who blow up Shia women and children, for instance, they deserve only our contempt and our scorn. And I think liberals, by and large, generally do feel that way, but sometimes it doesn't get heard in all of the anger at George W. Bush. I don't have a problem with anger at George W. Bush, but I think liberals need to be much more vocal and aggressive about saying that we are repulsed and disgusted by the evil that we have seen in some of the people we're fighting against in Iraq.
But you talk in the book about the liberal tradition, it counsels patience, and you say we must be prepared for a defensive war because armed vigilance is the best way to deter aggressive action. How does that play into 9-1-1? I mean, it seems to me if we just sit back the way you suggest, that how do we defend ourselves?
I think it's very important to distinguish non-state and state actors. And I think one of the things the Bush administration did, which I talk about in the book, The Good Fight, is which was really, I think, intellectually misleading, was to suggest that because jihadists could not be deterred, and they're absolutely right about that, you can't deter al-Qaeda or jihadist cells because these people want to die, and because deterrence is based on the idea that you have a state that wants to stay in business, and you threaten that state with putting them out of business by nuclear retaliation, and so they act pretty cautiously. That's right. We have to use preemptive action against terrorist groups, but that is not necessarily the same as a state, no matter how awful a government it is, be it Iraq, Iran, or even North Korea. Remember, we deterred Stalin, we deterred Mao. These were horrible, horrible people. But there was a general logic of deterrence which suggested they didn't want to start a nuclear war that would lead to their deaths and the defiance of their government. And I'm not saying that deterrence always works. There are exceptions. But I think the Bush administration hasn't given it enough due.
Do you think Iran is deterrable?
I would say this. I think that someone has to explain to me why Iran is not deterrable. Given the fact, again, as I say, the deterrence worked very well in the Cold War against much more terrifying enemies. I mean, let's remember, the Soviet Union was much more terrifying, had a vast nuclear arsenal. Khrushchev said some crazy, terrifying things about how Hubert Humphrey went to visit him once in Moscow, and Khrushchev said, where are you from? And Humphrey says, Minneapolis. And so he goes and circles Minneapolis on a map and says, okay, we won't bomb there. Mao was a complete nut at certain points. He had nuclear weapons in the 1960s. So given that deterrence has a good record in international affairs, you have to make a very specific argument to me, given what we know about Iran's history and the way its government works, that says that, in fact, they won't be able to be deterred. Maybe you can convince me. Ken Pollack tried to make this argument about Saddam in his book, The Gathering Storm, and he tried to find a lot of evidence. But you're going to have to do better than simply saying he's crazy, he wants to go to Allah, or to quote one or two awful statements he's made about Israel. I think you really need a very careful argument, one that I haven't really seen marshaled on the more hawkish side of the Iran debate yet.
Well, you'll be relieved to know I don't favor a nuclear strike on Iran. So I won't go hard to argue for one. And besides, you're the one who lives in the D.C. area, so you're putting more at stake in being right about this than those of us who live out in the heartland are anyway.
Well, but, you know, you could put it the other way, too. I mean, imagine if we do, you know, let's say we have some preemptive strike against Iran. The impact and the potential generation of the next creation of jihadists from the outrage and anger that will spark throughout the Muslim world, that puts me in danger in Washington, D.C. Also.
So apparently it gets you really upset if people are angry with the United States.
No, the question is why they're angry at the United States. If people are angry at the United States because we are not living up to our own principles, as I think we have not in Guantanamo Bay, and we have not been more generally in the way we've prosecuted the war on terrorism, then I think that's something we should be concerned about, not because they're angry, but because we should be angry, because we believe that we are a great nation, even a divinely inspired nation, with a mission not just to be like all the other countries in the world, but to set a standard for them, to be a kind of a beacon. And the lesson of the Cold War liberals that I write about in my book, The Good Fight, is the miraculous idea that you can struggle against a terrifying evil foe and in the process become a better, freer nation in the process. For instance, civil rights, part of it came out of the anti-communist impulse. I haven't seen that from George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and I think it's what we need back.
Well, what would they do that would be equivalent to the civil rights era today? Come out in favor of gay marriage?
No, I think I am in favor of gay marriage, but I wouldn't draw
Me
that
too.
Parallel. I think the first and most obvious point is that in a globalized world where people can see more and more easily what happens inside our own prisons, the way we treat our own detainees, by far the most important kind of public diplomacy, you know, they keep on trying to brand America and find new advertising slogans. That's not it. The way we show the world that we mean what we say about democracy and human rights is by acting well. It's on a thing like Haditha, by not trying to cover it up, by being absolutely open and saying, we are capable of being barbaric like other peoples are under conditions of extreme stress and without legal restraint. But what makes us different from them is the way we respond to that. Like, we use it as an opportunity to show that we're different from our enemies because we bring our own people to justice. And beyond that, I think one of the things that the Cold War liberals knew, and I talk about this in my book a fair amount, is that unless Americans were feeling stronger at home, they would not have the fortitude for a long, sustained struggle against a totalitarian enemy. And I think the increased economic insecurity, particularly of working-class Americans since the 1970s, imperils our ability to fight this long war.
Yeah, I noticed in the book you hold up sort of the economic structures of the 1950s and 1960s, sort of the John Kenneth Galbraith new industrial state sort of thing, as a major source of strength for the United States. And I remember when I read that, thinking that, well, they have that in France, and it hasn't really seemed to cut down on jihadist sentiment or to give them the necessary backbone to stand up to it when they encounter it. What would be different about what you're proposing?
I'm not saying that we can or even should replicate the structures of the late 1940s and 50s. We probably can't because of the changes in the global environment and in technology. What I'm saying is that the American social compact, which was based on the idea that corporations were benevolent, they took care of people. In the United States, unlike Europe, government did less for people in terms of health care and pensions, but corporations did more. That started to break down in the 1970s, not because corporations are evil, but because under increased economic pressure, they started to defect from, they became much tougher towards labor unions, which they had generally tolerated. In that circumstance, I think government has to be more proactive. Instead, government has retreated as well. I think there is a great need for government to act on healthcare, on job retraining, on the kinds of things that allow people to be flexible in this new economy, but have some kind of economic security. I think what we know is that if people do not feel economically secure, if they know that they are one illness away or one job loss away from bankruptcy, and bankruptcy has gone way up in the middle class, they are not risk takers. Conservatives want people to be risk takers, but people, I think, take risks when they have some sense of a safety net underneath them.
Yet the economy and everybody I know is doing better than ever. I mean, I don't know anyone who isn't doing well, and I'm not just saying that. I work with working class and lower class, you know, levels all of the time as a psychologist, and I see people doing better than ever.
Well, I think what the studies show, interestingly, Jacob Hacker, Yale, has been doing some interesting research on this, is that fluctuations of income have risen very dramatically in the last couple of decades. That even people who on aggregate look like they're doing okay have much more terrifying ups and downs because of this lack of the kind of guarantees and safety nets that people have. So the level of bankruptcies have gone up tremendously. And another reason people are keeping their heads above water, you know, wages have largely stagnated for people without college degrees since the 1970s, and people have been able to maintain their standards of living because women have entered the workforce in very large numbers. The average American two-parent family works 12 weeks longer a year than it did in 1969, and that puts enormous cultural stress on people. I think it has to do with some of all the fears of cultural and moral decline we face about how children are being raised. I think government really has a role in addressing that.
Well, you know, you have a chapter in the book that this sort of correlates. The Great Society was something like that. And of course, it actually coincides with the rise of the New Left and the decline of the Cold War ethic you've got. And indeed, you've got a chapter entitled Losing America that tells the story of how, after a generation of liberal anti-communism, the momentum on the left was captured by groups like the SDS, SNCC, and a general spirit of rebellion for rebellion's sake, where communism was seen as okay because it was rebellious. I wonder if you see a parallel in the reaction of people on the left to the war today, and certainly the Che t-shirts have made a comeback. You see Hugo Chavez being idolized by people on the left for no real other reason than that he's anti-American and anti-Bush. Do you think this poses similar risks for the left?
I don't think it's the same kind of situation. I mean, there was a kind of cultural transformation, even cultural revolution that was taking place about race, about gender, about sexual orientation in the 1960s and 70s, which was very disturbing to many Americans and some degree understandably. So I don't see that on the left today. I see an enormous amount of hostility to Bill Clinton, as much, maybe even more than there was towards George W. Bush, as much as there was on the right towards Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and certainly an alienation from him and the things that he stands for. But I don't see that kind of deep alienation from bourgeois values that I think was damaging for the left in the 1970s. You know, on college campuses you see a little bit of it, but I don't really think it's that mainstream amongst liberals today.
But yet you talk about the NASCAR man and how everybody, you know, thinks about this NASCAR man who's the epitome of southern style. And you talk about how this NASCAR man sort of looms over every conference that you go to. Could you tell us about that and how that relates?
Sure, but I think in a way that's the opposite. You know, mm-hmm. The thing is that Democrats and liberals are so afraid of you know, kind of red state, you know, Joe Sixpack guys, because they feel like those guys keep handing elections to the Republicans, that they're desperate for ways to appease them.
You know, I don't see
those
any.
Those guys don't like gun control. Fine, give up on gun control. Mm-hmm. What I was saying is that I think liberals have lost the recognition of the importance of just showing that they have conviction. And standing up, you know, George W. Bush said, I think one of his best lines in the 2004 presidential campaign was, "You may not always agree with me, but you know where I stand." And it's interesting that both Al Gore and John Kerry were attacked less by the Bush campaign for being too liberal, as they had done with, say, Michael Dukakis in 88, and more for not having convictions. And I think the Democrats are underestimating the value of just standing up on what they believe.
And in fact, you have an article entitled Nice Ass, which is in a recent issue of The New Republic, and you state that liberals are too nice. Is this part of what you're saying?
I was actually saying that liberals are too nice to one another,
okay,
in the way they conduct their internal affairs. That they that at these conferences I go to, this is a little bit tongue in cheek, but that, you know, liberals don't tend to have this kind of business mentality that I think Republicans do, and that makes it harder for them to impose order even amongst themselves. So there's a little bit of anarchy that tends to reign here because no one is actually willing to say, you know, shut up, don't turn off your cell phone, you know, stay and participate in the conversation. Where Republicans, I know, say that wouldn't be tolerated.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I've been sort of watching what's going on with the Democrats, and there's definitely a degree of, it seems to me, infighting, particularly hostility toward Hillary Clinton that you see on some of the Democratic message boards and such. And that seems to me to be a problem. It seems as if you can't win the Democratic nomination if you're to the right of Hillary Clinton, and you can't win the general election if you're to the left of Hillary Clinton. So does that mean that the face of 21st century liberalism is going to be Hillary Clinton?
Well, it may well be. And, you know, I think Hillary, we don't know how Hillary Clinton is going to run in 2008, but I think Hillary Clinton has actually been, you know, unfairly caricatured by the right as as this loony left-wing person. And the truth of the matter is, if you look, you know, what we know best about Hillary Clinton is her views on kind of on social policy and childhood-related issues. And if you look at what she was saying in the early 1990s when she was more vocal, she was in some ways to the right of her husband. I mean, this safe, legal, and rare stuff on abortion, that was hers back in the 1990s. It's not a recent invention out of polling. She's actually always been a certain kind, I think, of cultural moralist, even though Republicans don't want to acknowledge that. Whether it'll be her or not, I don't know that... it's not entirely clear to me what will mean to run to the right or left of Hillary Clinton. I mean, if you look at Al Gore, let's say Al Gore runs. Now, Al Gore, you know, was a hawk. He supported the Gulf War, very aggressive in wanting interventions in the Balkans. Yeah, he opposed the Iraq War, but you know what? I supported it, and I think Al Gore was right, and I was wrong. He's talking a lot about global warming. Does this mean he's so far to the left? I mean, people on Fox News will say so, but I've got no problem with criticizing people who I disagree with on my own camp, but you've got to show me a little more than that he opposed the Iraq War to tell me that he's some kind of crazed leftist. I mean, Brent Scowcroft opposed the Iraq War.
Well, it's really going to be very interesting to see. One final question. You're careful to distinguish liberals from Democrats in the discussion here. And I wonder, with all the talk of a third-party candidacy, most people think it's going to be somebody peeling people away from the right. Do you think that Democrats have something at risk from a third-party candidacy as well?
Not right now as much. You know, Republicans are probably the 51% party now, as they were in the early 90s when Ross Perot emerged. So there's more space, I think, to peel off from them, just as George Wallace peeled off from Democrats when they were the majority party. Democrats right now are very hungry to win. You don't hear a peep out of people like Ralph Nader anymore. I think that the people who are most, it seems to me, ripe for peeling off are probably downscale, angry, alienated working-class Americans, particularly upset about immigration, maybe not crazy about free trade either, who see that view not really being reflected in either party. There are some of those in the Democratic Party, but there are more of them in the Republican Party, I think.
Well, thank you so much. Any final thoughts as to why somebody should buy your book and what they'll get out of it if they do?
Well, to conservatives, I would say... you keep on saying that liberals don't have any vision, any ideas, or that liberals don't really want to defeat this enemy. And I'm trying to say no. In fact, I think we do, and I think here's how we're going to do it. And I think you may not agree with everything in the book, but I think I'm trying to take up a challenge to some degree that's been thrown down by people like you. So you would find it interesting to see how well I do in response. For liberals, I would say this is really a book about what our values are, what our principles are, about what liberalism meant when it was a term that liberals wore with pride. And if you want that to happen again, as I do, I think that it's worth engaging with this book and thinking about our very rich legacy of fighting totalitarianism and making America a better society in the process.
Well, thanks very much. I'm going to be very interested to see how your book is received on the right and on the left.
Well, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Well, that was pretty interesting, I have to say, and I really admire him for putting this view forward right now, because I think it's a time when people on the left aren't real receptive to the notion that there is such a thing as a good fight, other than, of course, the fight against George Bush. I do have a few problems, though, and unfortunately, he was pressed for time, and I couldn't ask all the questions I wanted to ask. One thing that struck me, though, was that he holds forth the Kosovo intervention as an example of doing things right, and yet Wesley Clark himself said that was technically illegal under international law because the UN didn't go along, and the reason why the UN didn't go along is that the UN is corrupt and ineffective when it comes to preventing genocide, as we've seen again and again. But certainly the book's well worth reading, and I hope it'll start a good conversation.
Well, it just seems to me that when a liberal defends America, it's the good fight, but when a conservative does, it's called imperialism. On the other hand, I do think that the book was very good. It was very well written, and there's a lot of good history. In fact, things about Truman and Wallace and other politicians that I actually didn't know, so it's certainly worth a read.
Well, I hope people will find these podcasts worth a listen, and you can check for further podcasts whenever we get around to putting them up. You can look on our blogs, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. And we're now putting our updates up at the Glenn and Helen Show.com. That's Glenn and Helen Show.com. So you can get it any way you want. And you can also subscribe via iTunes, which we like a lot. We'll be back whenever we get around to it. And in the meantime, have fun on the internet.
Talk to you next time.